You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. But, you know, Don, it's almost the end of July. It is the end of July. And it's been cool.
That's
all
putting it
July.
Putting it mildly, yes. Lois and I are preparing this show on July 30, 2025 for broadcast July 31, 2025. And the high temperature today is going to be 85 degrees. Average high temperature at this time of year is 93 degrees. So once again, coming in several degrees below average, tonight's low is going to be 56. It's going to be clear and sunny into the indefinite future. The day of the broadcast, 89 degrees and sunny. Thursday night, 57 degrees. First day of August, 90 degrees and sunny. Okay, closer to average anyway. Friday night, 58 degrees. Saturday, 90 degrees and sunny. Saturday night, 57 degrees. Sunday, 88 degrees. We realize there's a giant high-pressure dome building over many parts of the United States, and you're going to be miserable in those places because of how hot and humid it's going to be. So bear in mind that our humidity on these days here is in the 30s when we have a day in the low 90s or upper 80s. Very balmy and pleasant. Continued pattern right into next week. Monday is going to be 90. Monday night, 58. Tuesday, 91. So it has been, let's just put it this way, we're not going to soon forget July 2025 in terms of how anomalous and unusual and strange the weather has been. And it's mainly the daytime high temperatures that people have really noticed, but the nighttime lows have been unusually low as well. And we are seeing some side effects from that out in the garden, in the landscape. As usual, weather is the biggest factor in the problems we're seeing at our nursery. I can tell you, if someone were to sit down at my shop and just make a quick list of the problems that we see one after another as they come in, and they sorted them into insect, mite, fungus, and then what we generally refer to as abiotic disorders, things not caused by living things, things caused by the weather or drought stress or things like that, the overwhelming majority of the things that we see would be abiotic disorders. There are plants that have drought stress that are just marginally being irrigated. There are plants that have gotten sunburn on the west portion. There are plants that have the growth distorted because of a sudden drop in humidity or a dry north wind. That's a common one on citrus, for example. And many of the problems we're seeing year after year, every year, of course, are just related to high or low temperatures outside of the range of what plants prefer or are used to. I know I'm anthropomorphizing there, but when I say are used to, I'm referring to the general conditions which are optimal for their growth, as opposed to the extreme conditions which may lead to some physical symptoms like curled leaves, cupped leaves, things like that.
So has it been cold enough at night that we're going to have blossom end rot again? I know we have that at the beginning of the season for tomatoes, but can we have it in the middle of a season like this?
We can indeed. We had one 49 degree night about 2 weeks ago, and a couple nights 50, 51 degrees. And a good rule of thumb. Remember, these are not absolute. I'm just giving you the general parameter. Tomatoes, for example, prefer temperatures about 55 to 85 degrees. We get up over 90, they're okay, but it can affect the fruit setter development. If we get below 55, it can have some impact. And the most common impact I would expect from sustained periods of lower temperatures, coupled perhaps with erratic irrigation, the most common problem we see at our store, can lead to blossom end rot. And we've been talking to people a lot about it right now. So bear in mind, fruit development takes 6 or 7 weeks on a tomato. The fruit expansion phase is when we believe that blossom end rot is manifesting itself in the fruit. So 4, 5, 6 weeks ago, it was cooler, colder than average, and people were perhaps watering too shallowly or too frequently or something. And we do see blossom end rot. And of course, people want to know what to do for it. And we have a long conversation and send them on their way, assuring them that the next fruit will be fine. May not be the case this year. Hard to say. Next fruit should be fine, but we are having unusually cold weather. So I wouldn't be surprised if we do see, say, mid to late August, some more blossom end rot. That would be unusual. That would be one effect of the unusual weather we've been having is possibly more blossom end rot.
If the cold at night is what is problematic for tomatoes, is there anything that one can do to keep them a little bit warmer from the cold, but yet not overheat them with the heat? I'm thinking,
let's not focus on that. No? Instead, I would focus on your irrigation, because if you're watering deeply and fairly infrequently, not enough to stress the plant, but maybe water a little longer and skip a day or skip a couple of days, you'll probably be less likely to have blossom end rot than if you're still running your system every single day, as a lot of people are doing. So we do know that it's tied to irrigation practices, it's tied to temperature, and it's tied to soil ionic activity. If you've been feeding with ammonia, for example, sulfate of ammonia has been in years past a very popular fertilizer. Old guys really like it because it's cheap. We know use of ammonia fertilizers does correlate with blossom end rot, probably because of the impact it has on the soil ionic rhizosphere, atmosphere, whatever you want to call it. Main point being, the one thing you can do about blossom end rot is water deeper and a little less often. Can't really change the temperature all that much. And here's the other thing. Most people aren't having any problem with this. Most of us are getting really good set, really good development. I will say ripening is slowing down. I have a picture of my vegetable garden. There's one place I can stand, a vantage point where I can stand that gets a bunch of the tomato cages into the frame. And I happened to picture popped up from a year ago and versus this year. Now, a year ago it was really hot, but the plants grew great. And my plants are about 1 to 2 feet shorter this year than they were last year at the same time. I plant them all roughly the same time of year, so that's not exact. This is not a double-blind study in a peer-reviewed journal. But I'm looking at it, I'm going, a lot of those aren't quite at the top of the cage yet. And last year, they were up and out the top of the cage. So it's slowing down the growth a little bit. On the plus side, very good fruit set going on, particularly on peppers, but also heavily on tomatoes.
Does it make a difference which variety of tomato as far as the blossom rot, or are they all equally susceptible?
Roma is famously susceptible. If you're growing Roma tomatoes, it gets the first crop almost always gets blossom end rot, then the next ones come out fine. And I have grown varieties where I'm trying something new from a seed catalog, and I've had some where they just were so susceptible that I thought, I'm not going to bother with this variety ever again. It's on my database, but I'm not going to, I'm certainly not going to be touting that one. Yes, there is some difference with respect to varieties, and we do know that Roma is one that is always like the first to get it, but it outgrows it. The next ones come out fine. And that's the information that people walk out with is what I really hope puts their mind at ease. As I've said before, the old rule in retail is they walk in with a problem, they should walk out with a product. And God knows the horticulture industry is really good at filling that need. But many of the products that we push in our industry are either not effective or are irrelevant or aren't necessary. Let's put it that way. So there are sprays for blossom end rot, which don't really do anything, but they're out there. People want to buy them. They want to apply them. I've got it on my shelf if you absolutely want to buy it.
It fixed it. No, it didn't.
Right. It fixed it. Yeah, there's the problem. So most commonly, if I say, well, the next ones will probably be fine, that's usually the answer they're looking for. Pick them off, throw them away. Reminder, one listener commented that the fruit that has blossom end rot, the part that doesn't have the rot, he thought had better flavor, which I suppose is plausible due to the ethylene production in the fruit caused by the injury. Who knows? Whatever the case, you can still use the other part. There's no worm in there. There's no disease pathogen or anything like that going in there. It's just literally a physiological phenomenon. Yeah, we are seeing a lot of blossom end rot. On the other hand, I'm getting some really good results with certain tomato varieties. So I'm just going to give you two that have surprised me this year. Carmelo I haven't grown Carmelo in years. It's a European heirloom variety. It's a wonderful flavor. And my Carmelo right now has about 50 fruit developing on it. Haven't grown it for a long time. Haven't even really sold it that much in recent years. It just was another round, red, medium-sized tomato. And there's a lot of competition in that part of the market. So I just kind of dropped it. But I'm definitely going to be pushing this one again in the future because Carmelo is producing a lot of fruit. They look very good. Certainly no blossom end rot on them. Looks like one of my good performers this year. And once again, third year now out of four, Cherokee Purple. Heirloom variety. They're setting very well. They're ripening beautifully. And it's a really wonderful old heirloom variety. And it bucks the trend, you know, where I usually will tell you grow heirlooms for fun, but you can't really count on them for yield. Well, last 4 years, three of them at least, it's been a high performer. 1 year, it was my top performer, and it's on its way to being a very good one this year. So that's this week's tomato update. Peppers are setting like crazy, and lots of vegetables and stuff going on out there. Just keep in mind, we probably will warm up at some point. Looking at the extended forecast, which we were talking about, it's going to mostly be around 90, 91, 92 degrees. As I go to Ventusky, which is one of my favorite for-profit sites, which has all the cool graphics, and you can choose your model and you can go out several days. You can click on something, let's say 10 days out. The further out you get, the more variables that come into play and the less accurate it is. But at one of the models, 10 days out, you click on Sacramento, it says it's going to be 106 degrees. And then I like to take the cursor and drag it right down Interstate 80. And even the Davis-Vacaville area, they're saying closer to 100 than anything we've seen in the last couple of weeks. However, I then look at two or three other models. This is why I like the National Weather Service. Look at two or three other models. Oh, they aren't showing that. They're showing 98, 99 degrees 10 days out. So the one model is anomalous. What the National Weather Service uses is the blend of models where they average those things and remove the outlying figures. It looks like going into August, average temperatures, but nothing way above average from what I'm seeing. And if you are a fan of Weather Underground, which is a very popular for-profit site, it skews towards the high end, so they're showing higher temperatures 7 to 10 days out. You may want to plan your vacations or such accordingly, but be aware that they tend to use the model that is a little more of an outlier, in my opinion. This is why I'm a big fan of the National Weather Service. Didn't we have a couple PSAs to do? Go ahead.
It's this Saturday, August 2nd. The Raptor Center is taking their birds and their information to Pena Adobe Park. And if you need to know where that is, it's spelled P-E-N-A, Adobe Park. Go look it up.
Back of
they will be there from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. You can meet live raptors. You can talk to a local author, that's Aaron Hyman, during a family-friendly gathering at one of Vacaville's most historic landmarks. It's fun. It's going to be a great day. I don't know if this is the first time they did it. It's the first time I heard about it.
Okay.
And then the other competition that we have is the UC Master Gardeners of Sacramento County are having their Harvest Day. And Harvest Day 2025 is Saturday, August 2nd from, oh my goodness, Don.
It's all day.
They have speakers starting at 8:30 a.m. and they have stuff going all day long.
Yeah.
And, oh my goodness. Well, you're going to just have to look at this and plan your day.
Here's the one I want you all to go to. Go to the one at 11 o'clock by Quentin Young, Growing Avocados and Subtropical Fruit Trees in the Sacramento Area. Because I get questions about this all the time. There's a lot of great topics here, folks. Now, I'm just picking this one out because it's one that is quite relevant to my business. Avocados and subtropical fruit trees in the Sacramento area. Every few days, it seems someone comes in and wants to grow avocados. They want to grow the Carmen Haas is the most recent question I got. Well, that's a Guatemalan avocado. And I have to explain Guatemalan versus Mexican, which ones are cold hardy, which ones are not. Then someone will ask me if we can grow soursop, and I'm having to look up what soursop is to try and remember. It should be a great program, and he'll probably have referrals to the rare fruit growers folks who are really, really experts on this. But anyway, that's just one topic that they're covering at this, and it is this Saturday. So we got to head over there August 2nd to the Harvest Day Festival at, is it really a festival or just what are they calling it?
Harvest Day 2025, yeah. And the keynote speakers, they're, you know, that's the big things.
Yeah.
Well, they also have these little 20-minute mini talks throughout the day. And looking at two that are at 8:45 in the morning. Pruning caneberries
That's a
is
good one.
one, and creative ideas for getting outside. Yeah, getting outside is something I have trouble with these days. So, yeah, whatever you can do to get yourself out. Anyway, lots and lots and lots of stuff.
Creative
And they
ideas
also
for
have
getting outside. I
spinal.
love it. Okay.
Yeah. And service dogs are the only dogs that are allowed at the Fair Oaks Horticulture Center. So have a good time.
Fair Oaks Boulevard, Fair Oaks, California. There's a map and directions at the ucanr.edu link to this. And it's this Saturday, so you can go to some of those talks, zoom over to Vacville, and say hi to an owl or a hawk. All right. There's
And
also.
they have food trucks, so you can have there too.
Very important. We've got some great programming here at KDRT, and we always like to mention some of the other hosts and shows. And here's a fun one. The show itself, Davisville, has been on KDRT since the very beginning. Bill Buchanan is the host who presents stories that have some connection to Davis, has won 14 Excellence in Journalism Awards from the San Francisco Press Club, National Hometown Media Award for Excellence. Bill just does a great job interviewing people all across the spectrum of interest. And the most recent one, I wanted to mention this one. And these are all available there. It's a public affairs show. They stay there forever, just like Davis Garden Show does. So you can go to kdrt.org and look for Davisville. July 21st show was about bookmenders. Bookmenders is people who is a group which repairs books.
At the
And
library, at
like
UCA, at the county library here, you can go and watch them work sometimes.
And they come all, with all kinds of problems. They gather every Tuesday to work around a long table inside the main Davis Library, and they fix books. The most recent one was a puppy chewed training book, as an example.
A puppy training book.
Puppy training book that needed to be repaired. I wonder why.
Oh, I like it.
Hey, fun topic. And there's been the San Francisco Mime Troupe was a couple of weeks ago. So Bill interviews all kinds of fascinating people. Davisville, which was the name of Davis before it incorporated 100 plus years ago, is live Mondays, 5:30 to 6 p.m. These programs rebroadcast periodically. This one rebroadcasts on Saturday morning, right before the Davis Garden Show on Saturday morning. So check out Davisville on KDRT with Bill Buchanan.
All right. So we've got a lot to talk about today.
Yes.
Well, we have a message from Melissa, who is in Glendale in Southern California. I have a tomatillo plant that was happily coming along. I noticed today that the ends of it are crumpled, misformed. Pictures are attached. Could this be damage from a lack of watering? But will it be okay? What do I do?
So that picture showed distortion of the foliage, and I've had people bringing in pictures like this to me occasionally on tomatoes and peppers. And there's some places where you'll take those pictures and they'll tell you that you have a virus. There's other places where you'll take them and people will tell you that you've had exposure to a garden pesticide, which is possible. So those two I should dispense with. First of all, viruses do happen. The simple diagnostic for that is wait and see, because the new growth will come out continuing to be affected if it has a virus. If not, it will just grow out of it if it was a weather-related phenomenon. Temperatures that are colder than average would affect, this is here, I realize this is a listener who's not in this area, will affect the expanding leaves of many plants. Remember that plants have meristem, which is the cell division tissue on the edge of the leaf that's dividing as the leaf expands. And if something disrupts that, like a sudden low temperature snap is the most common, a cold snap by our standards, or very low humidity due to a Santa Ana wind or the north winds we get here in Northern California, as that tender leaf is expanding, the meristem will be injured on the edge. It will stop dividing, but the leaf is still expanding, so it will buckle. It'll look distorted. It'll simply crumple or buckle or get distended in some ways. So that is very likely what you're seeing. I should, however, mention that garden herbicides of various types can cause this problem. Dicamba, 2,4-D, and sometimes glyphosate, if they're used anywhere nearby, in the case of the first two, they can volatilize and drift and damage nearby plants. So that could be part of what you're seeing. If someone used a weed killer on the lawn and the lawn is right next to it and the roots got in there or it drifted up and hit the plant, that could be what you're seeing. In which case, it also will probably not outgrow that readily. More commonly, you're just seeing a weather-related phenomenon, and the new growth should come out fine. So it's a matter of just monitoring, as we say in integrated pest management, monitor the new growth. If during relatively tranquil weather, the new growth comes out unaffected, then we can realize that you just had a weather event that caused the distortion of the new growth. One other thing that can cause these kind of symptoms in our area, and possibly in your area, is thrips. Thrips is an insect. It's very tiny. You don't typically see them, although you'll find them in light-colored roses, sometimes down in the bottom of the petals. And they can get on the new growth of plants, especially in our region, citrus. New growth that's pushing out, you'll get thrips on there. They feed in a particular manner that just causes the leaves also to buckle, much as with the weather. It's very hard to tell these things apart. The answer in each case is to follow the well-established strategy of procrastination and just continue to monitor the symptoms. And if new growth pushes out fine or the flowers and fruit are developing properly, don't worry about it.
Well, Ken writes and says, "Hi, Lois and Don. I have this perplexing problem that I think with what I think are bay trees." And Ken lives in Menlo Park, California. "As you can see from the pictures, they are on the same side of the house. The one on the left appears to be thinning and dying, and the one on the right is vibrant. I think they are probably over 20 years old. I've only had the house for about 8 years. Any idea why one is thriving and one is not doing so well? As always, I look forward to listening to your show every week and following your excellent advice."
This is a case where the
pictures.
Yeah.
We're looking at a sidewalk going to the house, and then to the left is a tree which is up close to the house. I would almost say espaliered, except it's not attached.
Right.
It's just made real skinny because it's in a real skinny bed. And right. Then on the right is a tree, same size, but it is in a larger area, and so it has more root room. Yeah. So, Don, what are these?
Well, this was interesting. I'm glad you sent the pictures, and I was able to zoom in. And even though they look the same, the one on the right is a bay tree, and the one on the left looks like a magnolia.
Wait a minute. Neither of those trees are as short as this. This stops at the roof line of the house.
It could have been pruned that way. Yeah, this is where someone has taken an evergreen tree and pruned it kind of like a hedge, but trained it very, it looks rather cool, rather formal look where you do this. And then they've been clipping it that way ever since. And if it's been 20 years, this is the funny part. They look the same, but they're not. You can go ahead and take a closer picture of facing your house, take a closer picture of the one on the left and send that to us, and we can verify this and have a further conversation about it. Looks to me like the one on the left is a Magnolia grandiflora, probably one of the dwarf types of southern magnolia. If it's ever had a nice, big, fragrant white flower, that would definitely clinch it, but it probably hasn't because of how hard it's had to be pruned to keep it in this particular location. The one on the right looks like a bay tree. Now, bay are very easy to recognize. Just pull off a leaf, crush it, smell it, and it smells like bay. It is, in fact, the same bay leaf that we use in cooking. So it looks to me like someone took two different plants that look very similar, both have dark green, glossy foliage, and planted them to be trained in this particular way, of the rather formal look as a clipped, not hedge, but kind of accent or into the house. And they're keeping it below the roof line of the first floor. So they're essentially topping it as well. When you hard prune a woody plant over and over and over, year after year after year, at some point, some species run out of buds to break and grow and fill the spaces that you've created. Others continue that forever. One of the reasons that boxwood and privets and bay trees and yews are so popular for hedges and topiary is you can cut them as hard as you want, and something inside or further down the stem, a growth bud will break and grow. You'll expose it to light, it'll get the trigger to grow and fill in the void that you've created by pruning it. Others, and I would put Magnolia grandiflora in this category, they have a lot of those buds, but you eventually wear out the plant. Hypothetically, that could happen to anything that you're hedging on a regular basis, is that you just run out of rejuvenation wood. I don't know if you're going to be able to salvage that magnolia, because I think you're having to prune it too hard to keep it for another, say, 20 years in that spot. But this might be a blessing in disguise, because if it is, in fact, a Magnolia grandiflora, they have pretty aggressive surface roots. This is about a foot or two from your house. Well, I don't think it's going to go under the house. I think it could go along the foundation and could perhaps do some damage. So the roots of that plant concern me a little bit just because of what it looks like. I think it's a Magnolia grandiflora. Closer picture will, of course, help us decide that. But it's probably time for that to come out, because I don't know that you're going to be able to rejuvenate that one. By comparison, a bay tree, you can do that for generations. They have so many. If you cut a bay tree like a privet, cut it to the ground, it'll resprout. Cut it hard, it'll resprout. Thin it out, it'll sprout in the middle. You can kind of shape them any way you want. If you do nothing, bay trees get 50 to 60 feet. The biggest one I ever knew was over on Plum Lane here in Davis, was planted in the 1940s, was just taken out a couple of years ago. It was at least 50 feet tall and had a trunk 2 to 3 feet in diameter. That had been allowed to grow perfectly naturally. It was one of the most beautiful Laurus nobilis that I've ever seen. But more typically, they're planted where they are going to be pruned, especially in the Bay Area. They're used as hedges, formal accents, and this is being used as somewhat formal accent. You can continue with that. You could take out the magnolia if you're inclined to do that. For me, I'd probably just take out the magnolia and put in some cool shrub like Laura Petalum or some azalea or something that would give you showy flowers. But if you want to match the look, Bay Laurel is what you have, Laurus nobilis. You can just buy one in a 5 gallon, begin the process of training it in 2, 3, 4 years. It'll be filling in that spot very nicely. I'm pretty sure you got a bay tree and a magnolia. And when I say bay tree, I'm not referring to our native bay, the Umbellularia. Looks like the Mediterranean or Grecian bay laurel.
And the magnolia leaves are not green and shiny like one would expect them to be. They're
Right.
kind of a wimpy looking yellow. Does that mean it's just, it doesn't have enough roots? It doesn't have enough nutrition?
All the
It's
above. Yeah.
tired?
Yes. It's wearing out. It's running out of growth buds. The leaves are anemic. The root system is crowded. It's surrounded by a foundation and there's a path nearby. I mean, it would be possible to restore this tree with significant applications of nitrogen and possibly some trace elements because it looks like it's deficient in iron and magnesium and whatnot. But that's usually, to me, a sign that the root system is decaying and declining. So while it would be possible to restore this one, my thinking is maybe it's done its job. It's time for it to go. And I could, if this were mine, that would get dug out of there and I'd find some really cool and interesting plant to put in there, like Gruia caphora, lavender star flower. How's that? Think about that one. Or as I say, I'm a big fan of, here's one, Camellia sasanqua. Look at some of the sasanqua camellias. These are the fall and early winter blooming camellias. Yuletide would give a nice formal look. Setsugeka is a very informal, sprawling one. This is the really cool group of camellias, and they take very well to training as espalier or hedge-type plants, and they bloom really nicely in typically late October, November, December, depending on the variety. So there you go. Take out your magnolia and put in a camellia.
I'm wondering a little bit about the placement of both of these trees.
Yeah.
One is right next to the house, and we're talking about right next to like
Yeah.
a foot and a half away.
Yeah.
And the other is right next to a slab of a patio. Both of those things have concrete foundations. And isn't planting next to concrete a problem for trees with all the leaching and stuff?
It can be. It can be a factor in the yellowing, the micronutrient deficiencies that we commonly see because concrete is alkaline, and so it can lead to tie up of various trace elements. So it's not uncommon to see iron, especially in our area, iron, magnesium, zinc deficiencies when you're right close to a building. And those are pretty easily corrected. You can either push the pH down by applying sulfur, or you can apply the trace elements directly. Oftentimes, just feeding with a good source of nitrogen will take care of it. But I don't think that's going to take care of this problem because you've got a tree that's just being pruned hard and its root system is constrained. I think it's served its purpose and has probably outlived its usefulness. Hate to say that. But on the other hand, the bay tree looks great. So you can continue pruning that one as you like and then decide whether you really want to match that on the other side or go to a softer look with something that might give you some seasonal flowers. And there's lots of choices that you could put in there.
Yeah. I was wondering if what they put in to replace the magnolia, they had to worry about the concrete leaching.
If it's something that's called an acid-loving plant, which is a term that we use for plants that are said to prefer a lower pH, typically you're aiming for a soil pH, let's say 5.0 to 6.0 with an acid-loving plant, blueberries, azaleas, camellias, pyrus, there's a bunch of them that are in that category. Japanese maples are often described as being acid-preferring. You might want to turn in some sort of fertilizer that contains the trace elements, or even better, just mulch, mulch, mulch with good quality compost. What we do find is in our area is that when you have a couple inches of compost breaking down on the surface, that corrects pH problems even without correcting the pH. What we describe as pH problems are usually nutrient deficiencies that are caused in part by the soil pH, in part by other factors. We find that if there's organic material there steadily breaking down, just that process seems to mitigate the impact of alkaline conditions to some degree, salinity in the water to some degree. So when people started growing blueberries here in the valley, we were always telling them you need to apply this much sulfur when you plant them, blah, blah, blah. No, what you really found was a couple inches of compost on the surface all the time. made a big difference. And then they didn't have to worry about what they were feeding with. They didn't have to worry about trying to, quote, correct, end quote, the pH. Very hard to do. It's very difficult to adjust soil pH for more than a season. Even doing that is very challenging. And so it's probably better to just focus on a healthier soil environment, a healthier rhizosphere. It's our favorite term for 2025, a healthier rhizosphere, which is where the roots are, the whole environment, things breaking down, mycorrhizae attaching themselves to the, on or in the roots, bringing in the trace elements more effectively and efficiently for the plant and helping it expand its reach. I mean, mycorrhizae actually expand the reach of roots to take in more water, take in more nutrients. That seems to make more difference than any attempt at correcting soil chemistry in general. It's very difficult to change soil chemistry, but very easy to improve the soil environment.
Okay, so Asera, who I believe is local to Sacramento, asks us about oleanders. And so there's a bunch of questions here. Why are there so many oleanders in the area? Are they native to California?
We talked about oleanders a week or so ago. There have been a lot of questions that came my way because Caltrans is ripping out a whole bunch of them as they do some work on Interstate 80. And so we did talk about that. And I guess they were listening to the show and had follow-up questions. No, it is not native to California. Definitely oleanders. Interestingly, it's not exactly known what their origin is, but they're widespread in the Mediterranean and North Africa. Why are they widespread? Because you can stick a branch in the ground, it'll root and grow. It's a very, very easy plant to grow. You don't have to water them once they're established. You don't have to water them at all. And they'll bloom with showy, spectacular flowers no matter what you do. But no, they are not native by any stretch to California. So.
Okay, second question. Are they toxic?
They are very toxic. Oleanders are highly poisonous. I think we talked about this a little bit in the previous segment. It's very, very, very difficult for humans and pets and stuff to ingest oleander because they're very bitter. You will gag and choke right away. There have always been urban legends about oleanders. I've been hearing them for as long as I've been in business, since before the internet. Yes, children, I'm older than the internet. So since before then, people were talking about Boy Scouts poisoning themselves by using oleander branches to roast marshmallows or whatnot. There's no evidence of that ever actually having happened. None whatsoever. But even just a few months ago, someone said, yeah, her sister-in-law knew someone who, and it's always twice removed. And I said, I don't want to rain on this, but I heard that exact story 40 years ago. So I don't know
how it wasn't true then.
I don't know how old your sister-in-law is, but this is an old story and there's no evidence of it whatsoever. But they are poisonous. And the tragic case is their livestock. So that is the big concern with oleanders. They are very toxic, and the family they're in, other members of Apocynaceae are also quite toxic. It's an interesting group of plants. They have cardiac glycosides, is my recollection, which are usually tied up with very bitter compounds. So it's very, very, very difficult to ingest them. But livestock, in some cases, can chew and swallow things that wouldn't be a problem, you know, that would be a major problem for the rest of us. So that's the concern, is that every part of the plant is poisonous, including the blossom, including the the leaves and so forth. And also, this is important for people who have them in your yard, the sap can be both a skin irritant and is toxic. And so when you're pruning them, doing any work with oleanders, you should always wear gloves. But here's the point, folks, you should always wear gloves when you're gardening. Okay, I'm very emphatic about this. There are many, many, many plants whose juice or hairs or trichomes or whatever they have on them can cause dermatitis or can cause serious skin reactions. And short of keeping a list in your head of what all those plants are, the simplest way to protect yourself is to wear gloves all the time when you're gardening or handling soils, for that matter, because many soils are irritating to the skin as well. So when you're pruning oleanders, which they do need because they can get rather big, be sure to wear gloves and be sure that the prunings are disposed of properly.
Well, I hope that answers your question, Sarah. And
thanks for writing.
Yep. Go on. All right. Well, this is the end of July, and I just realized that we never went through the July calendar. I'm not going to bother with the, the chores or the opportunities,
please,
as I like to call them.
Yes.
I call them chores. He calls them opportunities. It's all the same.
Doesn't a chore sound like something you wouldn't want to do?
Oh, no, I love doing chores.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That's why I volunteer for so many things.
All right, let's look at August. Do you have August or July in front of you?
There's one I want to ask about, though, here on July. Maybe it's on August, too. Asclepias.
Yes.
It's a beautiful picture here. It's got red downturned petals or sepals or whatever, and then there's this upturned yellow, bright, brilliant colors. That's not the Asclepias I'm used to seeing. I mean, I thought Asclepias was milkweed.
It is, and it's a big group of plants. Asclepias genus contains dozens of species, and everywhere you live, practically there's some species that's native to your area. This is the tropical one that I happen to use on the picture in July. Yes, I see that's on there, Asclepias crassavica. This one has probably some of the showiest flowers in the group. If you're local and you want to buy the species that is appropriate to the Davis area, it would be Asclepias fascicularis, the narrow leaf milkweed, which actually grows native and wild on my farm. It's the one that would be here in the Valley Grassland plant community. If you want to grow another one that is native-ish, Asclepias speciosa, which is the showy milkweed, has a bigger flower, but it's all gray, pink, muted tones. The tropical one has very showy flowers. There is a ton of controversy about which Asclepias you can or should not plant. My direct conversation with our probably most formidable butterfly expert in the region, and also articles I've seen published by people who know about butterflies and the various parasites, will tell you, as far as the scientists are concerned, you can plant whatever kind of Asclepias you want. It really won't make any difference. But having said that, that's heresy. I'm never supposed to say that. I'm only supposed to say, only plant the one that's native to your region. And I'm telling you that the people who know what they're talking about don't agree with that. But if that's what you're after, the native ones are fine. They're pretty. They're interesting, but they're not as showy as this particular one. Milkweed's a great plant. It's very easy to grow. It is toxic. I always want people to know this. The sap is very irritating to the skin and really bad for your eyes. So if you're thinking of doing a milkweed project with a preschool, maybe not the best place for milkweed. If you are going to do it in a garden bed where kids are regularly visiting, it should be in the back of the garden bed where you can look at it from several feet away and no one will be tempted to walk up and break off a piece and get that milky sap on them, get it in their eye, because they'll probably have to go see the doctor if that happens. But it's a very tough and adaptable plant. This is the tropical one, which is the showiest one. So it's the one you're likeliest to see in garden centers because growers of bedding plants can get it to bloom the first year from seed, which almost all the other Asclepias will simply not do. It is also now banned for sale in certain Southern California counties because the ag commissioners down there, responding, if I might editorialize, to unfounded pressures, decided to make it illegal to sell the tropical milkweed. You're welcome to do your own research on this topic. If you want links to the publications that I'm referring to, send me a note at davisgardenshow@gmail.com, or just buy the native one in your area, and that's totally cool as well. Biggest difference for me is that the tropical one dies in the winter in our climate, USDA Zone 9, it freezes out completely, whereas the native ones, of course, don't, and they also reseed rather happily. So if you want something to naturalize in an informal garden, plant the native ones to your area. This one is fun for the bright colors, and all kinds of butterflies go to Asclepias, not just the monarchs. People grow them for the monarch caterpillars, but the adults also like to visit the flowers, as do many other insects, including butterflies, as well as even hummingbirds. And in particular, gotta mention this, the one thing I see visiting my Asclepias here on my farm very commonly are tarantula wasps,
What?
which really, really, really like Asclepias flowers. Tarantula wasps, the tarantula hawk. If you find my page on Instagram, Don period Shore, Shor, I post a little video I took the other day out in my garden of a 2-inch tarantula wasp attacking and parasitizing a 3-inch wolf spider. It took about 3 minutes total, and I got almost all of it on video. It's amazing to watch this extremely aggressive towards spiders, not people. Wasp going out and attacking a spider much larger than it, parasitizing it. And when I went back later, the spider was completely gone, had been dragged into the burrow of the tarantula hawk, where it is now parasitized and will become a food source for the larva of the tarantula hawk. It's a kind of a gross and morbid thing, but fascinating to me. As a kid, these things were all over Southern California, both the tarantulas and the tarantula hawks, and we have them here. And so if you happen to be admiring the Asclepias flowers and you see this wasp with about a 2-inch, 3-inch wingspan that's a vermilion, bright orange, jet black body, comes scooting in to go to the flowers, that's a tarantula hawk. Tarantula wasp. We do have them in this area, just as we have tarantulas in this area. I know that comes as a shock to many people. And these are not aggressive to people, but their sting is perhaps considered to be the most painful sting of any wasp in existence. So
Don't grab it.
tell the kid not to do what my friends and I did which was catching them in butterfly nets to see how irritated we could make them and then releasing them. Leave them alone. You don't bother them, they won't bother you. But they are, people ask me about this particular wasp. Yeah, it's a tarantula wasp. Yes, we do have tarantulas here. Try not to think too much about it if you're arachnophobic or don't like big wasps. These are not dangerous unless you do something foolish, but they're very attracted to the flowers and milkweed.
So I want to talk about one of the flowers here. We'll do the rest some other time because we aren't even into August yet. But on your August calendar, you have Amaryllis belladonna, mm-hmm. which is Naked Ladies.
Yep.
And mine came out 2 weeks early this year. It was pretty amazing. So mine are already in full bloom.
And, same here.
And it's the end of July in 2025.
And that mine usually blooms, start blooming in late July. They hold the blooms right on through August. This is Amaryllis belladonna. This is not the amaryllis that you're growing at Christmas time. That's the common name of Hippiastrum. Amaryllis is the actual botanical name of what we all refer to as naked ladies. Amaryllis belladonna, South African, if I recall. Foliage grows, comes up in the beginning of the rainy season, grows rather lush through the winter, dies down in April or May. The plant is completely gone, except that these are generally planted shallowly so you can at least see where they are because their necks are sticking out of the ground. And then sometime in July and into early August, up come these bare stems, hence the name Naked Ladies, and at the top of them, these lovely pink flowers. And this is so well adapted to California that it has naturalized in the Mendocino County area and other parts of coastal California. The plants in my garden that are blooming now were given to me by my mother more than 40 years ago. It's that kind of a plant. I've dug them up and divided them and given them away and put them back in the ground. It's just incredibly easy to grow. In fact, it's kind of a sign in some areas of a place where a homestead used to be. I mean, we've been growing them in California for 100, 150 years. It's one of the early plants brought into California by European gardeners. And so if you're out hiking around somewhere and you see these growing out in the wild, look for a footing of a foundation. There probably was a house there at one time. Very adaptable here, usually medium pink. There have been some people doing some breeding on them, so you get some range of pink, but typically it's just a nice clear pink and it's one of the easiest bulbs you can grow. The key is you aren't going to find them at most nurseries. They're not in the bulb trade, or they barely are. And if they were in the bulb trade, they'd be disappointing because if they were harvested, shipped to the Netherlands, shipped out all over the world as bulbs are, brought into nurseries in September, sold to you in October, you took it out of the ground in July, August, planted in October, that bulb will not bloom for several years. If you do want to grow Amaryllis belladonna or Naked Ladies, you should find someone that has them. And as soon as they finish blooming, you should ask if you can divide off of them, because that's the way you'll get a nice, healthy bulb that you plant in the ground. Don't bury it too deep, real important. That'll typically bloom the following year, just right on track. But if you wait too long, the plants grow fine, but it may be quite some time before they bloom. Other than that, sun is fine, shade is fine. My mom gave me a sack of these in the 1980s, and we started sticking them in different places all over the property. Some of them never see sunlight. They're in total shade. Some of them are in full sun. Some get watered, some don't. They do equally well in all those different places. So it's very, very, very well adapted to California. Now I'm going to answer the question, how cold can it go? By looking in the Western Garden Book, which I always keep a copy of when we're doing these shows, and the answer is Amaryllis belladonna goes down to zone 4, sunset zone 4. So you can grow these in much colder climates. Native to South Africa and grows into Western Oregon and Washington and all over California. Okay.
So I'm looking at the calendars, and I note that at the top, upper left-hand corner, and average high temperature in July is 93.
Yep.
Average high temperature in August is 92.
Mm-hmm.
Don, didn't you show me something about the averages, what we had this year and last year?
Yeah, KCRA3 has been posting about the weather. They are the great ones to follow on. Facebook is where I found this. And they were using Sacramento. So just to, we will, as I've said earlier, we will not soon forget the weather in July 2025 is how anomalously cool it was. How cold was it? Well, normal, if you want to call it that, high would be 93, and a normal high, low would be 60, Sacramento. Davis runs slightly different, but close enough. 2024, it was a hot summer. July, we had two long heat waves that basically made the whole month feel like it was a heat wave. So remember, that was 93. Well, 2024, the high average was 98.5.
Wow.
That's a big difference, yes. And the night temperature, the average was 63.5, which may not sound like a lot, but that means there were a number of nights in July 2024 that were uncomfortably warm by our standards. How about this year? So that was, let's see, average 93, 2024, 98.5, 2025, 89.
Wow.
So nearly a 10 degree average high temperature difference from one year to the next here. And the night temperature average was 57.4 in the month that we're just concluding. So again, a 6 degree difference there. It was last year, July 2024 was actually three heat waves and only a couple of days of what you would call normal to average temperatures, well above average for the whole month. And 2025, well below average for pretty much the whole month as well. There were a couple hotter days. I mean, they gave us the data here. There were 8 days above average in the entire month. In Sacramento, they did get to 102. We in Davis officially hit 99.5. So technically, we didn't actually even have a 100-degree day in the month of July 2025. Below average, 20 days in July. So that should be good for tomatoes and peppers and things like that, where we're always concerned about the high temperatures preventing pollination. But we're looking at some of these nights where it was 80, some of these days, excuse me, where it was 80, and some of these nights where it was 49, 50, 51 degrees. That might have had some impact. That might be affecting, I know it's affecting the rate of growth and how quickly things are ripening. Other than that, plants seem to be fine. But as mentioned at the start of the program, blossom end rot has been more of a problem this year and may continue to be as the effects of the July temperatures manifest in late August.
So Don sometimes will pass along comments from customers who walks into his store, and usually when they're talking, the first question he asks is, "So how are you watering that plant?"
Yes, indeed.
And this one, the answer was, "I'm doing drip, 30 minutes, 3 times a week." Now
Okay.
I've got a question for you on that, Don, and I know that if you say I'm doing drip, the how many gallons per hour is your drip emitter, et cetera, et cetera. But when I say I'm doing drip, I don't really mean it's a little drip emitter. I mean it's like one of those little mini sprayers. It's smaller than a penny and it squirts water out.
Oh, mini sprinkler. Okay, sure.
Yeah. And so if I were answering your question, I might answer it like this, meaning something different. So how do you get them to explain what you mean? Do you hold up the two things and a
Well,
drip
kind of. I
emitter?
mean, when they say we're doing drip, we tend to assume that they're referring to a drip emitter is on a line, in or on a line that is putting out water at a fixed rate. Your typical drip system is just a line of half inch tubing, 5/8 inch tubing, and emitters are either already in the tubing when you buy it, emitterized tubing, they call that typically, and that's the most common that we're dealing with. So come back to that in a moment. Or it's just a long thing of blank half inch or 5/8 inch tubing, and you, the person controlling it, have put an emitter in where you want it. That's what I do. My basic irrigation system on my property, where I'm not using a sprinkler or a rain bird or something like that, is a long line of 5/8 inch black drip tubing, and I put emitters near each plant. Because I may be 10, 20, 30 feet between trees on the farm. It may be an orchard. It might be shrubs in an ornamental area, but I don't need water every 1 to 2 feet on that. I need water near the tree. So my drip system looks different than other people's. But most commonly, they're referring to something where emitters are either already pre-installed in the tubing or they're putting it in themselves. We do have to answer that question, though. Ask that question. Because as you say, micro sprayers, mini sprinklers, and bubblers are all components of drip irrigation systems that distribute the water rather differently. One of the contractors who comes in, who likes to install drip for people, really likes the bubblers that you can take quarter inch tubing, attach it into the half inch tubing, and then you have like 3, 4 feet of quarter inch tubing, and you can just stick that in the ground right next to a plant, and you can open it out or close it down. So you can control the flow from anywhere from 1 gallon an hour to as much as 10 gallons an hour. If they're at that level of sophistication, they usually know more about how to irrigate than the people we're talking to who have problems. But we do need to kind of suss that out. If they're using mini sprinklers, which are on risers but in a fixed location, spraying towards something, they're very popular, but they take a long time to give a reasonable amount of water. So I would have to ask, are you using mini sprinklers or bubblers to get at what you're getting at?
And
Drippers.
a pot. Are you using a pot? Because that's a biggie.
Well, that is, and that's much less common, fortunately, because container drip systems are totally different. You may run them for 2 minutes and get what you need. I mean, you're just watering potting soil. So it's a very different conversation than drip systems in the ground. And it's very challenging, by the way, if you have containers and a drip system nearby and people want to put the container on the drip system, well, that's going to run for like 30 minutes, 45 minutes. That's way more water than the container needs and probably not anywhere near enough for the other plants that are on the same line. So they're not usually compatible. But to get to your point, what type of emitter or sprayer is actually an important part of the question. We operate on the assumption that they're using one of the common commercial brands, especially if it was installed for them by a landscaper, Netafim being a well-known brand which has emitters in the tubing, or if they bought it from us, they bought the tubing and they stick the emitters in themselves. We have conversations about that, but 30 minutes with a conventional Netafim system that puts out 0.4 gallons per hour from each emitter is putting out 0.2 gallons. Okay.
It's a cup. No, that's
much more than a cup, but it's not by much. It's closer to a quart. It's a little less than a quart. And that is, there's almost nothing where that's enough water. I mean, this is the point. These systems really need to run a lot longer. I can't think of any time I'm running my drip systems less than 1 to 2 hours. And that's just for annual things, you know, where I know that it's a relatively shallow root system. Three times a week, a quart of water isn't going to do it for most things. And, you know, we repeat this over and over because the most common problems we see at our nursery are related to deficit irrigation, underwatering, not watering long enough when you do. Frequency of irrigation is the concern, of course, but and that's what we're usually referring to when we say overwatering. But people have gotten this overwatering word in their heads thinking, I can't run it for 2 hours. That's too much water all at once. You could run it for 24 hours. It'd be a waste of water in some cases that, you know, go down to maybe different plants' roots than you were intending to get it to. But it's not a matter, overwatering isn't how much you put on all at once. It's how often you water. And the concern with overwatering is inducing crown rot or root rot by keeping it too damp right at the surface, right around the interface of the trunk and the soil, and causing Phytophthora to attack the plant. That's what overwatering refers to.
Can we change that word instead of saying overwatering?
I wish.
Over-frequency?
Over-frequency, yes. Watering too often is really what overwatering would refer to. But it's creating conditions that predispose the plant to infection by Phytophthora. That's a little complicated. Doesn't exactly trip off a ton.
I like over frequency. Oh, yeah.
Too much greater. Okay. Anyway, so 30 minutes, three times a week isn't going to do it with any drip system. We have someone did ask me, is there anything you water daily? Yes. And you can see it every day.
Bonsai.
Well, yes, bonsai is one. Most of our nursery actually we water daily because our nursery is hundreds and hundreds of plants in fast draining soil. So we do water every single day. In the ground, if you're driving by Redwood Barn Nursery, the flower border out front, I do water daily. I run the micro spray system out there every day for the flowering annuals that we put in constantly. So we're always churning things that are out there. Just yesterday, one of my people went out and cut back this overgrown plant. And they stuck in some more flowers. So we turned on the system for that. And my experience has been for short season, shallow rooted annuals, and many flower beds are in this category. Daily watering for 30 to 45 minutes is fine for just those plants. I don't assume when I do that the ginkgo tree in the bed or the shrubs along the back or the rose bush down there is getting what it needs. There's a separate line in the same bed for them. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I have a Y coupling, and I usually water them at the same time I'm doing the annual flowers. But then I turn off the annual flower part about once a week, and I let the other line run for a couple of hours, if not all afternoon. All afternoon is for the ginkgo, and a couple of hours is for the roses and the other things that are out there. So woody plants, bigger plants, I do a deep watering. Annual plants that are in the same bed are getting daily watering, and they get that because they're basically growing in amended soil that's only 6 to 8 inches deep, and when we pull them out, that's as far as their roots have typically gone. We're growing flowers as if they're in containers, even though they're in the ground. A lot of I've managed in the course of my career many annual flower borders. Typically, they're heavily amended. Customers do that on their own. Landscape gardeners will do that. It goes against all the stuff we tell you about soil, but it works for this purpose. You're taking a couple inches of really good compost that's enriched. You're turning it in. You're digging it in the foot deep. You're planting into that. You're sticking petunias or impatiens or whatever in there. Pull some of those out at the end of the season. I usually tell you to cut them off, but pull a couple of them out and look at the root systems that you achieved in the course of 4 to 6 months in the ground. most of them haven't gone past that amended soil. Partly, perhaps they're lazy, if you want to anthropomorphize a little bit, but also it's just an annual. It's just something that's only growing for that part of the season. So I do water those frequently. And I've found in that particular bed that's along a sidewalk with reflected heat, daily works very, very well in that situation. I could skip a day now and then if I wanted to, but I get very good results doing that. In general, deeper watering is better. And less frequently is better to avoid the risk of root and crown rot.
And you said, I think I heard you say that in that bed that you're watering daily, you're using micro sprinklers?
Micro sprayers along the front, and then the bigger woody plants have drippers next to them. Yeah, but
okay. So when it's on,
right, when it's on, it's spraying into the bed, and we let it run exactly 38 minutes because at 39 minutes, it starts to run out over the sidewalk. So we can't have that. That's against the rules. So, by the way, minor digression, but if you are driving down Fifth Street and you are looking at that bed, there is a perennial in there that is moving steadily up to the top of my top 10 list for perennials. And this one has amazed me for 20 years plus, and it's been migrating past some other old favorites to get right up there in perhaps the top five. Rudbeckia fulgida goldsturm. If we renamed this, we'd sell a lot more of them. Okay. I don't remember what goldsturm means in German, but whatever it does, Rudbeckia is well-known black-eyed Susan. That's Rudbeckia hirta, the biennial black-eyed Susan. Rudbeckia fulgens, I have seen, F-U-L-G-E-N-S, I have seen called brown-eyed Susan. Looks like a miniature scale version of black-eyed Susan. Goldsturm came into the trade in the 1930s. It's been around for a very, very long time. The plants that you see with a spectacular bloom out front at my nursery right now were planted at least 6 or 7 years ago. Whereas most Rudbeckia, if you get a second year out of them, you've done well. They're biennials, short-lived perennials. This one, spreading steadily but slowly, very well-mannered, blooming at about 3 feet high. It's along a sidewalk that faces west, so it gets full reflected afternoon sun and is thriving on that. It's getting watered daily because that's what the annuals are getting, and it's fine with that, but it doesn't need that by any stretch. It could go once a week with a good thorough soaking, and it would be fine. So there's all these new Rudbeckias, Echinaceas, hybrids, Ekebeckias, all this stuff coming on the market, fancy pants plants that just bloom once and that's it, you know, they're done. This one goes on and on and on, and the plant increases. So it's really a great perennial, but it's a little hard to find. Nurseries don't usually have a lot of them. Rudbeckia fulgens goldsturm.
And goldsturm is a German word, which means golden storm.
Okay.
So I always end our show now with a garden quote. And this time I am going to quote that famous gardener, Don Shore. And here we go. In the garden, there is always something blooming, and every season is a delight.
I said that? Sounds great. You're listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.